Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sabina Dietrich. I'm here at UXR and director of the Urban and Regional Analysis Program. This is our last Brown Bag Seminar of the year, number 9. I think it's been a great schedule, and for those of you who've been regular attendees, I'm sure you've enjoyed it. Bob Graddick has been dutifully putting these together with me and our team upstairs, so we're planning next year. When you ever have a suggestion for somebody, please give us their name. We're happy to have a mix of folks, and today we're going to be talking about GIS. So we've got some real GIS folks here, and we're really happy to see Kristen Curlin of the Heinz School, and she's a teaching professor at Carnegie Mellon in architecture, too. And David Wallace is assistant professor here at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Kristen joined with the faculty appointment in CMU's Architecture School and Heinz College and is nationally and internationally recognized for her work on GIS, particularly as they relate to health. Her research focuses on community design, its influence on health, and public policy can improve public health through thoughtful design decisions. Many of you know Kristen. She's been a regular attendee also of our Brown Bag Seminar, so she's seen a lot of these, and her work today is going to fill in many, many ways for us. Kristen is the co-author of the best-selling GIS book, has won numerous teaching awards, as well as Esri's 2012 Health Communications Award. And this year, she serves as president-elect of the Andrew Carnegie Society and a donor society at Carnegie Mellon. David Wallace is assistant professor in the Department of Critical Care Medicine and Emergency Medicine at Pitt's Medical School, and he was awarded a master's in public health and epidemiology from Emory University, worked as a staff epidemiologist in the Emerging Infections Program at the Centers for Disease Control. So got a few people, I don't know if they're here today, with Atlanta roots, so it's always good. He earned his medical degree from the State University of New York downstate and completed his residency training in combined emergency medicine and internal medicine at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn. He completed a critical care medicine fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh, spent an additional year as a postdoctoral scholar through the National Institute of Health's National Research Service Award training program, and currently funded NIH to study healthcare geography. So we're combining lots of interest today, and I think everybody's looking forward to a very, very interesting presentation.
Thank you. Thanks, and thanks for having me. And I just want to say how much I do enjoy these lunches. If you guys haven't been here before, they're wonderful. They're have a lot of great speakers, so I encourage everybody to come next year as well. So our talk today is going to be in two parts. I'm going to give a little bit more of an overview of where we are today with the technologies of GIS and as it relates to health. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the projects that I've worked on collaboratively. And one of those happens to be with David Wallace. So he's going to then talk a little bit more about some of those projects. Before we get started, though, we have this talk framed as from Jon Snow to today. So is everybody familiar with Jon Snow? Let me just talk a little bit about it if you're not. Jon Snow was a physician in London in 1854. And Jon Snow had a suspicion that a cholera outbreak that was happening there was not due to an airborne communication. And it was due more to a water contamination. And he had a really hard time convincing many of the public officials of this, and ended up creating these maps to look at where they had cholera deaths. And I'm going to just talk for a minute about it because it's really the first known GIS as we know it, especially as it relates to health. And a lot of people use this slide. They talk about Jon Snow. But what we want to do is relate what Jon Snow did in 1854 to what we're doing today. So if you look at this, this is the map of London. And this is what's called the Broad Street Pump. And this is, in fact, the pump that was contaminated, that was causing this the cholera outbreak. And what Jon Snow did, though, was he had these bars that represented the number of deaths in every household. And so by doing this a little bit more quantitatively, by looking at the quantity of people that were dying, he was able to then show the clustering of where these deaths were occurring. And then that, plus a lot of other efforts that he needed to do to convince the public officials, did finally convince them to look at the Broad Street Pump. And by the way, there's a great book, if you haven't read it, called The Ghost Map. And it's a wonderful book that talks a lot about this this particular case. So this was how Jon Snow was doing it in 1854. I'm going to fast forward to how we're doing it today. One of my collaborators is the New York City Department of Health. And boy, I'll tell you what, if you want to talk about a phenomenal GIS department, they have probably, I want to say, 40 to 60 people working on GIS in New York City. And one of the things that they have done is they now have a system where they take 311 calls. So they will take these calls continuously every night. And what they do is they will take these calls and find out where there are complaints. So this is a map showing where they have water complaints and are able to look at water quality that way. So it's kind of similar to what Jon Snow was doing by putting these dots on the map, but they're doing it in an automated fashion every night. The other thing that they're able to do then is create these, what we call choropleth maps, which are aggregating the data. So then we can start to see, are there areas of the city where we have more problems? So it's the same kind of idea, but we're just doing it with a new different technology today. Some of the other technologies that I just wanted to briefly talk about that you may or may not be familiar with are a lot of mobile technologies. So this is a project that we had done at the Heinz College. A team of students in my course were working with a physician that we have in a program that where we teach physicians. It's called the Master of Medical Management Program. And one of our physicians came to us and said, we want to start, he was with WellPoint. And it's an insurance organization in Virginia. And he said, we want to start directing people to the nearest urgent care instead of directing them to an emergency room. And so one of our students said, well, we can help model that. And they were able to then use GIS and base mapping to say, where are you and where are you closest to the nearest urgent care? And they did it first as just a prototype website and then ported it to a phone device. It became so popular, and this was a course project. It became so popular that WellPoint adopted it, and they're actually using it now. If you're familiar with Esri, Esri is the big software developer, the big GIS software developer. They're doing a lot with mobile devices now as well. And so they have a whole system where you can take your maps and you can put them online, but then you can also get an app and start to view these on your mobile devices. So we can take a look at these maps, we can zoom in, we have all of the smartphone and smart tablet devices that we can start to look at all of our data this way as well. So this is, I think, a big push of where we're seeing the industry headed. We were just talking about social media and capturing all of this information in social media, and that's going to start to be integrated into a lot of these devices too. Other devices that allow us to now open up into other worlds. So we do a lot at the Heinz College internationally. We have some work that we're doing now in Africa. And it's no longer restricted to saying, okay, we have to be in this urban area connected on a Wi-Fi device. We can have these mobile devices anywhere. And HealthMap is another organization from Boston. This was developed originally at Children's Hospital in Boston. And it was basically looking at outbreaks and where are outbreaks occurring. And again, we're using social media and different devices to report this. And I just did a search here at our location, and we see that we do have, of course, a number of influenza outbreaks, and so we can have these mobile devices and start to report it and look to see where these are happening. Just wanted to very briefly talk about what's happening nationally and internationally. A lot of healthcare organizations now are making their data available. So I've done a lot of work with the National Cancer Institute and the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control, and a lot of these places now will take data and for the most part they aggregate it. I assume a lot of you are involved with health and everybody knows the privacy issues. I don't know, I always tell my HIPAA joke, so I'll tell it now so you know. So knock knock.
Who's there?
HIPAA.
HIPAA who?
I'm sorry, I can't tell you. and so, one of the things that I'm teaching my health GIS class right now, and all of my students are, if you're not familiar with healthcare, they all say, oh, we're going to do a great project, and we're going to do a project looking at obesity because we know that you've done this kind of stuff, and we're just going to call the hospital and get all their obese data, and then we're going to, and I said, no, it doesn't work that way. You can't necessarily just call and say, I'd like to get all of your data. And so one of the things we found, though, was that a lot of these organizations do take their data and aggregate it. So very often we can get data from the Centers for Disease Control. We can get it at the county level, depending on the different projects. We can get it at neighborhood levels. And so the data is out there. And one of the key things is, where do we go to find all of this data? And it's often in very strange places. And I'll talk a little bit more about some strange places where you can find this. Some of the state data. The state of California has a great website. And it's the California Healthcare Atlas. And there's all kinds of information out there. And so, again, they're starting more and more to provide it in a geospatial environment, in a geospatial way. So we have this data, whether it be county data or census data. People are becoming more familiar with this, and they are providing these types of data sets. And these are just some examples. A lot of them now are doing both the interactive maps. So for those people that aren't necessarily GIS experts, they will have that data where you can go out and you can start to create your own maps. But then what we're typically more interested in is, how can we get that data and download it and do some of our own work? And then again, New York City. There's a number of different venues that New York City has for collecting all of this data and then making it available for people to use to evaluate. And then ESRI, this is the big push that we're seeing in general. Will Gore and I are very often collaborating with ESRI because we have our books. And ArcGIS Online is really, I think, one of the futures we're going to see for their portal. They have a lot of data that they collect, both from national organizations. They have all of the data from the U.S. Census available. And by the way, that's very useful. Last year, when the government went down and data, all the data was shut down with the government, I realized that ESRI is a private organization and they still had that data. So we're able to go and get a lot of this data in the back door through them. But this was a map, too, where somebody was mapping all of the supermarkets in the U.S. And it was a map that this person had created and shared. And this is looking at food sources in the San Diego area, but they have it for the entire U.S. So, again, this portal of where this data is being stored, I think more and more you're going to see a lot of the geoprocessing done online as well. So one of the futures that they keep talking about is all of the geoprocessing that we do on the desktop, you're going to be seeing done in a cloud environment. If you haven't seen this, this is one that we use a lot in health. This was, again, a tech support guy. I always said he was a programmer, but he's not a programmer. His name is Chris Olson. His wife went to graduate school here at Pitt, and he always loved the geography of Pittsburgh. And so he went to Pitt's online archive of all of the Sanborn maps and stitched them together. And I'm not doing it justice because it's this little slider bar, and you can see the little slider bar moving along here, looking at historic Pittsburgh over time, but it's in a flex viewer. And so it's a really beautiful way to start to look at how Pittsburgh has changed. And you can look at the entire city here. I'm just kind of zooming into the downtown area. But you can look at the entire city. And we use it in the health environment because very often we're looking at the built environment and we're not sure what was there in the past. I've done a lot of work with the Allegheny County Health Department, and we were just talking recently about one of their buildings is in Lawrenceville. And where the health department is was an old arsenal. So we were talking about lead poisoning and how lead can be in soils. And so often we don't know what was here in our environment 50, 100 years ago. And so these maps are very useful when we're looking at the environment. I wanted to tell you a little bit, too, about non-typical users. I recently gave a talk at the in Washington at the at a media organization. And the media organization were all of the online news organizations. And we were looking at, and I was talking about GIS. And there I met a data delivery guy. And in media, newspapers and online media, this is a great source to get data. Reporters are always out getting good data. And Matt Chittum is the data delivery editor for the Roanoke Times. And Matt has done a lot of work related to health. And when I was talking about searching for data in different places, Matt has this site that he had for food deserts. And if you continue to just move along, he has a link here to where you can download all kinds of data, and this was from the USDA. So when you're out looking for this information, again, don't just, you know, look at the typical places. There are all different ways to get this information. And in fact, at the conference, geospatial data was one of their top 10 tech trends. So we're starting to see a lot in journalism and in media. There's a whole group now of analytical journalism that is looking at GIS information. I want to shift gears and just talk briefly about my collaborations. So I made this slide for a talk I gave at Carnegie Mellon last week talking about crossing boundaries. And one of the things we were talking about is collaboration. And you know, we've been collaborating with Bob and Sabina here at Pitt for many, many years, and we're all interdisciplinary. At Carnegie Mellon, I'm in the School of Architecture, the Heinz College, and I also teach in civil and environmental engineering. And so in ourselves, we're very interdisciplinary. The fact that I'm architecture and public policy, I'm going in a few weeks to our campus in Qatar, and then we have a campus in Adelaide, Australia. I put in here places like the library. We're doing a lot of geospatial work now in our Hunt Library, and we have a librarian that's very interested in helping people look at geospatial data. Over here is a list of the different health organizations that I've collaborated with. So there are quite a lot. And what's interesting is when I first started looking at the world of health, I started to say, okay, well, I wonder who's already doing stuff related to health. And I started doing health research about maybe about 12 years ago. And I thought everybody was doing work related to health and GIS. I thought, oh, this is going to be great. I was really surprised to see how few people were really integrating health data into GIS. So the way I did get involved in it was this book that I was writing for Esri. And it's a tutorial workbook. And what we were doing was we wanted to teach people in the health profession how to better use health data. And so back then, you know, you have a clean slate. You have to write a book. You have to have projects for the book. So that was the first thing I did. And just so happened that one of my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon was working with the health department. And he said, you know, the health department has this grant that they just got from the Centers for Disease Control, and it was a capacity building grant. And he said one of the things they wanted to do was look at how they could start collaborating amongst themselves. There are four groups within the health department, a group that was looking at lead, food, water, air, and housing. And they really didn't know how they could kind of overlap, but they knew data might be one way that they could do this. And so they said, okay, we're going to meet with you to talk about what we could maybe contribute to the book, but at the same time, that'll help us learn what each other's doing and how we could maybe have projects within the health department that overlap. So what came of that was that the turns out that the water and the air people were already doing a lot of geospatial work with other organizations here in the city, but lead, food, and housing really weren't doing a lot of geospatial work. So in particular, lead came to the top of the list. And the leader of the lead department there said, I'm really interested in looking at a few things. I'm interested in looking at where do we have cases of kids with elevated levels of lead in their blood. And he wanted to map that compared to old housing. And he wanted to see, was there a correlation between lead paint and when we had lead paint taken out of houses and kids who had elevated levels of lead in their blood. And so what we did again, once again, was we aggregated this data because we had every kid, but we couldn't, of course, include that, especially in a book that we were publishing. And we aggregated that data to block groups, and then we took the census data looking at the age of the houses. And you can see that, of course, Pittsburgh grew up around the rivers. So we have all the older housing near the rivers, and then we have the suburban areas where we have newer housing. And in fact, we then ended up doing a lot of this spatial joining and looking at the actual data. And we did have a lot of kids that were in these areas of older housing. But we also found that there was a correlation between socioeconomic data as well. So we had kids that lived in these poor areas. And of course, we were looking at different housing variables. So we looked at things like median gross rent. And we looked at other variables. We looked at educational attainment. And if you think about this, people that live in these more affluent areas probably are more prone to taking better care of their homes and these older homes that were dilapidated. They may still have lead paint in the house. And so it was not just the older houses. We started to explore this a little bit more. We also then said the county has housing complaints. And so maybe we can look to see if we have cases where we have people that are complaining about the housing. So this is just a flavor of some of the examples we were doing. Ultimately, the director of the lead group was able to take some of these maps and go to some of the pediatricians in these areas and say, look, we have elevated cases of lead in these areas. We want you to do better screening. And so ultimately, we created a little environment where he could zoom in, create his own maps, and then take those to different pediatricians. The work that I really started doing, though, was with childhood obesity. And again, it was about, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I went to some endocrinologists at Children's Hospital and said, you ever done any mapping on any of your patient data? They said, nope, we have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, well, what we could do is look at your patients. And these were patients from the Weight Management Wellness Center at Children's Hospital. And it's interesting, the project is funded by the Department of Defense. Everybody always looks at me and says, huh? The Department of Defense, why are they funding this project? Turns out it was the late John Murtha, congressman from the middle of the state, was able to get funding for this project to help kids in his district. And that includes Western Pennsylvania, middle of the state. And they also agreed to do this because they were gonna open a weight management wellness center in San Antonio at the Lackland Air Force Base. So we did two groups of patients. We looked at two different scenarios. One, what we did was we looked at kids' progress over time, which is a little bit different from what a lot of obesity projects are doing. A lot of obesity projects just look at a snapshot of where obese kids are right now. And what we had was a great database of when they came to the center, and then 5 years later, what was happening. So we looked at over time a kid's BMI Z-scores, basically. And so a Z-score is a kid with a negative number is a kid who lost weight. A Z-score with a positive number is a kid who gained weight. And what I did was I looked at these are the kids where they lived, and then we went in and looked at parks and fast food. And so I created these buffers around parks, and then using GIS tools, I was able to see kids who lived near parks and kids didn't live near parks, and what the outcome was, basically, was kids who had a BMI Z-score decrease, kids who lost weight, about half of them lived within 1,200 feet of a park, and they lived a little farther away than kids who gained weight. Kids who gained weight, actually, 83% of them lived further than 1,200 feet of a park. Now, this was all just exploratory. There's a lot of other things you could start to look at. One of the things we said, we should probably look at what the conditions of the parks were. Just because you live near a park doesn't mean that you can get to that park and you can, have healthy exercise in that area. We ultimately looked at things like crime and other, things that were happening in their neighborhoods. But this is just an example where, it is important to know what is behind that park. This is a kid who lost weight, and that kid has a pretty straight shot to the park. And you can see that when that kid gets there, there's a lot of open green space, there's a lot of things to do, as opposed to this kid, and this is where he is on the map. This kid, it's a little bit more difficult to get to the park. And when that kid gets to the park, it's a big wooded area. So there's really not the amenities, there's not the free open space to be able to do some exercise. Why is that important? Well, that's what brought the architects into this. And again, this was back in the days where they two hadn't talked to each other. And I said, well, maybe we should start to look at your physical environment. And we want to talk about how you can get out and how you can be more active. One of the things that the physicians told me was that they want to have this habitual exercise, not just go to a sport, do it, and then go home and continue to watch TV or play computer games. How can we get this daily activity into our lives? I should tell you, too, some of you have heard this story, but never, ever ignore an email you get from somebody. I got this email right after I'd done this project, a few years afterward, and Tammy knows the story, I think. I got an email from a guy by the name of Sam Cass, and it said, hi, can we talk? And I said, I don't know who Sam Cass is. I was about ready to delete it, but I went on my day. And I came back from classes, and a student of mine, a former student, said, "Heads up, the White House chef is going to be emailing you today. His name is Sam Cass." And so it turns out that Sam Cass was, it was just when Michelle Obama was starting to look at her initiatives. It hadn't even been called Let's Move or anything. And he said, "I heard about this obesity work you're doing and the mapping, and it's really interesting, and we're looking at all kinds of things." And he said, "And you know, I now know that architects are very involved in a lot of this." So anyway, I'm glad I did not delete that email. But again, it's that exposure, and how can we get people talking about this? Related to parks, I've done a lot of work with the trauma team at Children's Hospital, Barb Gaines and Noelle Zuckerbrunn, and I have done a lot of work looking again at green space. And this was just an initial study looking at injuries. Now, the one thing about this project was we were the only data we had at the time was data from Children's Hospital, kids under the age of 14 with severe injuries. And so we only had about 100 or so cases to look at. And we wanted to look at the injury rate by neighborhood and then the green space density. So one of the things that we found was that we did have neighborhoods where we had a high injury rate, but then we had a high number of acres, but there were some areas where we had high injury rate and a low number of acres. So ultimately, kids were being more injured when we had less green space. But again, what is that? How does that all relate? We wanted to look a little bit more closely to see if we had a correlation between parks. One of the things that we suspected was that if a kid lived near a park, they would be less likely to be injured. They wouldn't be out playing in the streets. They would be actually playing in those parks instead of just out where cars were driving. And we did find that the kids that lived within that closer buffer, again, of the parks were less injured. The youths were, it was about 30% higher in the buffer that wasn't quite close to the parks. And then also we, on our own, decided, let's take a look at poverty. And we did, and we were thinking single moms that may be in poverty, might not have the access to watch their kids. We did find that there was a correlation between that as well. So again, how does that relate to what we can do with action? One of the things we did was we went to the city. And actually, we also went to, at the time, it was Councilman Peduto, who now you know is Mayor Peduto. And we marched down to him and we said, we need to get better data because we only have this limited data set. And we knew that PennDOT had a bigger data set of injuries, but they didn't want to give it to us. They were afraid that if they gave it to us and we mapped where kids were being injured in the city, they may be liable for areas that they might not be looking at or improving. And luckily, I don't know if you know this, but Bill Peduto said, yeah, he said, I was actually hit by a car once downtown. He said, so I'm really interested in this project. And we had since done a lot of other projects with students at the Heinz College, looking at where we did have injuries. And then that led to a lot of initiatives that he has done, looking at making some of our streets safer. We also went to the city planning department. And in fact, this ended up becoming an initiative that the mayor had, looking at green spaces in the city. And we were looking, this is a map just showing where we have green spaces and where we have just the number of kids under the age of 18. And we were looking at which parks might take priority. And by the way, I should tell you, and Catherine, it's probably the same way in the county, the city has things labeled as parks, but everything that they have to mow is a park. You know, so grass, everything with grass. And so we have like urban boulevards, and we don't really encourage kids to play on an urban boulevard because that's a park. So when you're doing these kinds of studies, you have to go in and actually, maybe take some of that out of the equation there. But we were looking at real estate around parks. We were looking at what parks might we might be able to use for improvement. And I also did something for the schools where we looked at, this was a project where the director of the physical education of Pittsburgh Public Schools was saying that many of our old buildings aren't conducive to exercise. And we have these kids, we can't get them exercise within the building. And she said, can you show me for every elementary school within a 5-minute walking radius how we could get to a park, or is there a park even nearby? So could we actually walk to a park, have the kid do some exercise in the park, and then bring them back to school within a reasonable period of time. So this was a whole series of maps we did for the schools. And then lastly here, I just wanted to show you just some other GIS technologies. This was a project that we had done for the Pittsburgh Food Bank. And this was creating kernel density maps of many census variables. Kernel density or hotspot maps, sometimes they're referred to. The red areas are where we have people that are at high risk for needs of food, the food services from the food bank. And so we had about 8 different criteria as to who would be in need of a service like this. And we labeled them as high risk, low risk areas. And then the black dots were showing where we had member agencies. So these are organizations that actually distribute food for the food bank. And using some GIS tools, we're able to extract the risk area. And so, for instance, these are the agencies that are serving these areas in high risk. So this was really kind of a site study to see, are we actually serving people that are in need of food services, or do we have gaps where we have people that we might want to pursue to add places. So these are just this is just a flavor. One of the things that I encourage everybody to do, when I gave my talk at Carnegie Mellon last week, one of the people from the audience came up to me and said, if you could give one bit of advice, what would it be for people? And I said, set a goal for yourself. I myself wear a jawbone. I don't know if you guys are familiar with these, but I used to wear a pedometer, and I always lost it, so I ended up getting one of these bracelets to see how much I walk in a day. It's not a lot. I thought I was walking a lot on campus, all over campus, all day long. But I set a goal for myself, and I see I don't live really close to a park, but I try and get that physical exercise in every day. And there's a website called walkscore.com. I just did it for here. It's a very walkable area. You guys would be happy to know. What are the amenities?
Great.
Bad parking school, but good walk score. But anyway, so just how do you get out and stay physically active? There's a lot of ways to do this, and try and incorporate it however you can. So there are many other projects that we've done. I especially do a lot of collaboration with Children's Hospital. We've looked at all kinds of other issues. I'm always continuing to do different kinds of projects. Also different kinds of organizations. I've done a lot with the Central Blood Bank, looking at donors for the blood bank. And that kind of leads me into our next speaker, which is David Wallace. David took my class a couple of years ago. We started talking about interesting projects that could be going on. I'll tell you, he's one of the people in the health industry that I always say to Esri is the up-and-coming guy who's done a lot of interesting things. So what I would suggest to everybody is if you're interested in these kinds of topics, get together with people. Get together with Sabina or Bob or me and David or anybody who's interested, or Catherine, and just collaborate with all of these, because we've done a lot of great stuff crossing other boundaries and different disciplines. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to David. David, he's going to talk about some really interesting stuff.
I don't know about you guys, I'm going to get that outbreaksnearme.com app, help figure out what I'm doing tonight, go Urban Spoon, Yelp, outbreaks.nearme. Okay, so I saw some heads nodding when Kristen brought up Jon Snow, but we're going to take a little bit of a deeper dive into the world of Jon Snow. So yeah, this is the map that Kristen showed before of the area around the Broad Street pump. And just to create some context, so 1854, so this is before germ theory, this is before Semmelweis, before hand washing, thousands of people dying in central London, like bodies on the street, and this was really, really hardcore. And so this was, Jon Snow's theory was that, as Kristen brought up, that this was a waterborne disease, but a lot of people thought that it was being conducted by air. And the story, at least when I was at Emory, I heard about Jon Snow and Semmelweis on a daily basis, and I had this view that he just came in and he made a map and everybody was blown away, and then he did all of the hash marks, and that was the end of it. But that's really not the full story. So here we're looking a little bit more closely, and Kristen already showed this, and 500 people dead in 10 days. This was the week before he showed this map. And so he puts the crosshairs right on the Broad Street pump, and he says, here it is, so obvious. But the Board of Guardians, they were unconvinced. There were competing theories. There were others out there that thought something else was happening. They just didn't buy it. And when you look at the area, one of the things that came up was they said, what about these two buildings that we have here? There are no deaths, and this is a high population area, and this was a real stumbling block. And so for the first time, when Snow brought his maps to the public health agency, they didn't believe it. So he actually had to go back. And he created this second map. And this is really where he is clearly an innovator, but this is where I think things get particularly interesting. So he creates this second version of the map, and this is done for another group at St. Luke's Parish. And he adds an additional feature. He's going to put in a regular line, which he draws around the Broad Street pump. And what this is not immediately apparent. But what he did here is he showed the area that you could be living in, and the Broad Street pump would be the closest pump to you. Okay. So there are other pumps in this part of London, but he showed that this was the area that's most likely to be affected if the Broad Street pump, in fact, was the culprit. So this was a huge innovation. And so here's this map again, now just zoomed out a little bit more. The red dot, this shows you the Broad Street pump, but here are four other local pumps. And this is called computational geometry. It wasn't called that at the time. But what you can do is you can actually draw out these areas. And these have a name. These are called Veroni diagrams. But the mathematician Veroni wasn't even born yet at the time that he did this. That's why I think this is so innovative. So if you're in the red zone here, you're closer to the Broad Street pump than to any other pump. And so John Snow, he didn't draw it quite this way, but he did create two regions based on proximity and counted cases within the proximity to create an attack rate. And so this second map was really the one that moved the needle, or at least so the historians say. So there's his map. Looking at the prior map, that didn't give any respect to the fact you can't walk through buildings. So this is actually from just a couple years ago. You can also create this kind of map, but saying how far, if you were limited to staying on streets, could you go? What's the closest pump to you if you were walking rather than walking through buildings? So the red area here actually starts to look a lot more like the map that John Snow made. So this is really interesting. So the story does end the way that Kristen presented it. So in the late summer, the Board of Guardians removes this handle from the pump, and cholera cases decline in number. Interestingly, cholera, I'm half Polish, cholera is actually like a swear word in Polish, and I remember my grandmother saying it, it's cholera, and the idea is to like wish cholera on someone. That's how bad this was. So cholera cases go down in number, waterborne transmission of cholera is later established, not by Snow, but by others. Solidifying germ theory. This is kind of the rise of public health, and then he gets a tavern named after him, and that's the area today. So an interesting piece about this that some of you may know is, so what is the story with the two buildings? And yeah, exactly. So one of those is a brewery, and the people that lived there never drank water. And then the one next to it was a monastery, and they had monks there that were also brewing beer. And This was shoe leather epidemiology, because he actually went to a number of different buildings and tried to figure out where people lived, where they hung out, what pump they were using. And both of these buildings, people are like, water? No water. We don't drink water. So that's why there were no cases there. Okay, so there are two major developments that I'm going to focus on. Obviously, he was an innovator, and there are a lot of things about the story that are interesting. But the two that I'm going to talk about and relate to some of the work that Kristen and I are doing relates to his observations about travel time and this idea of a catchment area. And a catchment area would be the geography around either the pump or a hospital or whatever structure you're talking about. It's the group of people that would likely be visiting that structure. So travel time estimation, I'm going to start with. So, you know, this would be like Snow Maps. Here's and then Google Maps showing where my office is and how long it'll take to get here. And this is something that we really take for granted. There are a lot of technologies out there to help with getting you from point A to point B, Google Maps being one of them. Obviously, Garmin, a number of other companies are working on this. And they're even now being used for answering some health questions. So this is really, this leads into the first project that Kristen and I were thinking about. And we thought, well, we have these technologies to try to estimate how much time it gets from point A to point B. We use it all the time for getting from point A to point B. How does that relate to public health, though? Is it valid? Because pre-hospital public health planning, and in particular EMS, they use technologies like this for informing the allocation of their districts, for obtaining funding, and really it all comes down to time to definitive therapy for acute care conditions is a benchmark. Time is a benchmark in many conditions. So acute MI, stroke, sepsis, trauma, time matters. So it really becomes important to figure out if our ways of estimating how long it takes to get from time point A to point B are valid. So this is really falls under this huge umbrella of access, and there's a whole taxonomy to what represents access. What I'm going to talk about right now is more specifically called accessibility, and it really has to do with the local geography. You could imagine that if someone was homeless and lived under a hospital, they may have no real access to the services of that hospital, even though they're close in proximity. So obviously, this is a much more complex model. What I'm going to be talking about is the simple piece, which is just feet and miles. So our question was, do our methods of estimating travel time apply to ambulances? And so this is a paper that came out last month, which was the results of this project. And we took almost 30,000 ambulance runs in and around the Seattle area, and then also in the Pittsburgh area. And we compared the recorded transport time to three different metrics. We used Google Maps to estimate how long it would take for that run. We used ArcGIS, which is the Esri product that Kristen showed many maps from. And then we also did something which is called linear arc. And this is really just as the crow flies. It just says how many feet from point A to point B in a straight line, and if you were averaging 40 miles an hour, how long would it take you? And so we compared these different methods, and then we also created maps to show what are the implications of using the different methods. How much does it matter if you use Google Maps versus TomTom versus ArcGIS? Does it matter? So what I'll tell you is that overall, Google Maps and ArcGIS performed well. Interestingly, if you read the article, you'll find that Google Maps actually did better, which was not what I expected, and maybe a little nervous. But I've gotten no hate mail from Esri. That was actually not what we expected. I believed. I've drunk the Kool-Aid. I love Esri. I thought that they were going to do a better job. But they actually did not have as accurate estimates. And there were some other things that we found that were interesting. There really was no seasonal effect. The time of day effect was quite small. And by that I mean if we estimated an ambulance transport that was at rush hour versus in the middle of the night, there was some effect, but it wasn't as large as we expected. There was a small day of the week effect. And by that I just mean weekend versus weekday. Importantly, we found that estimates were best for short transports, and that kind of makes sense to me. The longer the transport, the more variability you're gonna expect to see. This was the piece where we made different catchment areas to say, does it matter? Are they're different, but different has to matter. So the three numbers that you're looking at are the three different populations of people in Pittsburgh that you would believe you're capturing if you use the different methods. So if you use ArcGIS, then you are going to think that there are 960,000 people within a 20-minute drive of the five hospitals around Oakland, and so on. So you can imagine that as you start to get into bigger distances, it really does matter. And this has particular relevance for the edge, for the limbus around, because you're starting to get into becomes an at-risk population. You may be under or overestimating your access to those people, to those regions. And this is actually, again, this is pretty much the same thing that Jon Snow did, but obviously we were looking at it from a slightly different perspective. Also interesting, the use of Google, and Kristen talked about this, for our project we had to go through the traditional IRB ethics review board. We had to go through and make sure we're using some patient addresses. Can we actually upload this information through Google? And the way that we did it, we got approval. But I think that depending on the kind of question you're asking, privacy matters become very relevant. And even though Google did very well, it may not be ethically appropriate to use Google where you have no control over the data. And you may end up using a product like ArcGIS where you can have it kind of firewalled and local. So there are other reasons to use one versus the other. So as I said, our conclusions were really that these technologies are pretty good. So they are developed for ambulance use, but they are generally pretty accurate for EMS purposes. And I think that they remain valuable for decisions about system organization, public health access. And we found that over 20 minutes, you start to get into a kind of a gray zone where it's hard to really say that you have true accessibility to that region. So those were some important findings. And this was really just my first project looking at this, because I wanted to dig into really cool stuff that I thought about for critical care and start applying these. But really, the questions are often more important ones. You take a step back and you say, are my methods valid? Is my way of measuring this appropriate? So this was the first project we worked on. OK, so here's flu view from today. And this shows the cases of flu in the United States 2 weeks back. This is through the Emerging Infections Program and through the flu folks. And what you can see, and you guys all know, some sniffles out there, that flu is pretty much rampant across the United States right now. So this really was part of our thoughts on the next project, to think about flu and to think about public health access. And clearly, this didn't start 2 weeks ago. In 2009, there were a number of publications. And there was, obviously, you guys probably all felt it. I felt it personally getting H1N1 after a pediatric patient sneezed in my face in the emergency department. So there's a lot of interest in H1N1 and flu, but that has not gone away since that time. And then clearly when this movie came out, we knew we had to do something. So we started thinking about using some of these methods to look at public health access. So severe influenza, what was our question? Well, severe influenza can cause life-threatening respiratory failure. For the bulk of people that get H1N1, if you filled Heinz Field with H1N1 patients, only one of them would develop this super severe respiratory failure. But that person would be in deep trouble. And in all likelihood, that person is going to be on the younger or older end of the spectrum. And optimal management of that patient really requires specialized resources. So in the bottom left here, there's actually a person in there. So that's a bed that rotates upside down, one of the kind of advanced modalities that we use for treating patients that get themselves in that condition. And on the right, you may say, I can't see the patient. And you can't, because there's just so much stuff going on. So critical care is complex. It's resource intensive. It's high stakes. And for patients with severe flu, that's a hallmark condition of the intensity of the resources that are needed, the cost, and the possible consequences of not getting it right. So our question became, can we estimate geographic access to hospitals that can provide this kind of care? And this has already been done for a lot of other high-risk, time-sensitive conditions. So there are Dr. Murdoch's in the back there, so he's probably thinking about the trauma maps that have been out there for quite some time, looking at access to trauma centers. It's also been done for stroke. It's been done for neonatal cases. It's been done for a number of burn centers. It's been done for a lot in the past, but it has not been done for severe acute respiratory failure. So that was our thought. And here's how we did it. So we started by saying, we want to identify all the hospitals in the United States that manage a high volume of severe respiratory failure, patients that end up on ventilators. That's what that thing that looks like a robot is. So we identified all of those hospitals. And then we thought, there are other things that we do for patients that get into this kind of trouble. And one of them is, I'm going to call it lung bypass. But basically, patients' lungs become so damaged by the combination of the infection and then your own immune system trying to fight the infection that your lungs don't work. And even if you get put on, I'm bumming everyone out, I can tell. Even if you get put on a ventilator, that may not be good enough. So there's this way of bypassing the lungs and taking your blood, bringing it out of the body, oxygenating it, giving it back. Centers do this both for children and for adults. And so we wanted to look at access to those centers. So we're looking at two different groups of hospitals. And with the hypothesis that those are the hospitals that are going to be able to help that one person in Hinesfield that gets super sick from influenza. We also recognized that life is more complicated than just living near the closest hospital, and that especially for these kinds of conditions, often patients will go to their local hospital, and their local hospital will say, no way, cannot handle this, and then we'll send you on to the Mecca. So we had to model this complex relationship between the different hospitals. So our objective for this was to look at the population that lives within a one-hour drive of either referring hospitals or referral hospitals in the United States. So we identified almost 500 hospitals that had these capabilities of either doing a high volume of mechanical ventilation or performing this lung bypass procedure. And maybe not surprisingly, population access varied widely, and it varied widely according to region and to state. So these are the kinds of maps that you'll see for these types of projects, these accessibility, geographic accessibility projects. And you can see that the hospitals are, the majority of these are going to be located in predominantly urban areas. You can see that there are some impressive white spaces as well, where there's really not good access to these kinds of procedures and this kind of expertise. In peer review, we got this is actually under review right now. In peer review, we were pushed to do more, and that the feeling was that the white spaces were overrepresenting the country, and that really not as many people live there. So there are things that you can do where you can actually start to shrink down the spaces, and these are called cartograms, and that you make your surfaces really plastic and start to try to make your space be proportional to the population. Now, people that live in Montana may be saying, hey, wait a minute, that's not fair. Pennsylvania is getting a little bit more rotund. California is definitely growing. But this is interesting, and it's just to show you that there are different ways of looking at this. And so this is something that we're hoping will come out of peer review soon. Yes, it's a free tool that you can download through Esri. So for this project, our conclusions were that geographic access to these high capability centers varies widely in the United States, and that adequate access to the centers in the case of either pandemics or disasters, it's really going to depend on a high level of local coordination and regional coordination, really. So these two projects, I hope, solidify for you this idea that health and geography have a long history. GIS is a tool that really allows us to critically examine aspects of infrastructure and public health. And I think that GIS has special relevance for urban studies because the pump handles are not always apparent. And then, so Kristen left you with one thing. I'm going to leave you with, it's better to be lucky than good. Because if you look at Jon Snow, when the pump handle closed, the cholera epidemic was almost over anyway. So he's credited with stemming the tide of cases, but it was already done. So it was good timing on his part. And I have a number of collaborators, and I really encourage you to come up and talk to us afterwards. There are a lot of cool projects that are going on in my department and Kristen's many departments, but I know I'm definitely a junior investigator, always looking for new collaborations, new ideas. So, thank you.
Thanks, David.